across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Breitlow.
Back now at 7:06 on this Wednesday morning, July 17th. This is Up North News Radio. Unabashedly Wisconsin, brought to you by Courier Newsroom and carried by our friends on the Civic Media Radio Network. Nice to have you along. Coming up this hour, we're going to be talking in just a couple of minutes to longtime political strategist Joe Trippi, and we'll ask him his perspective on whether the messages coming out of the Republican convention in Milwaukee are going to be landing with moderate voters. In our homeroom segment, we'll be talking to Jennifer Berkshire, author of The War on Education. And Todd Alba will talk to us later in the show about his experience so far doing his noon to 2 o'clock radio show from inside the convention site. From Rob and Tigerton, and Rob, apologies for missing your note yesterday where you talked about listening to Sean Cassidy back in the day. Rob says, good morning from Tigerton, sunny and 56. Should be a very pleasant day for mowing lawns today in Tigerton. Yesterday after mowing, I had my favorite drink. I believe it's a pina colada he's got here. It was great. I hope someday soon to have a pina colada with my favorite morning radio team. That must be Greg Bach and meteorologist Brittany Merlot. Thank you, Rob.
That would be awesome.
That would be.
Yeah. Oh, wait. I think we have special intro music based on the weather for Brittany's weather segment. That was a long way to go just to get cool for the summer to talk about cooler temperatures. I immediately regret that choice. But Brittany, nice to have you here. And yeah, it is officially comfortably cool.
It really is. I'm so excited for it. The relief, no humidity. You can open those windows up. You can shut that AC off. Temperatures today are only going to be rising to the low 70s into northern Wisconsin. Some mid 70s will be felt down to the south. And that's it. We've got a ton of sunshine on tap, only a few clouds building in later on this afternoon, but nothing is going to be in the way. There is going to be no rain in the forecast. The only thing is a little bit of breezy winds, but those are out of the north, and that's what's pulling in these comfortable temperatures. And this is going to hold for tomorrow too. We'll get warmer towards the weekend, but I am going to soak up every bit of this.
Every bit of it indeed, because again, if we can get it warmer for the weekend when folks are swimming or not on the water and everything, that's great. Yeah. But for the work week and not having to run the air conditioner, works out just great. Brittany, thank you so much. Appreciate
You're welcome.
It. Have a wonderful day. Yeah. It's our pleasure now to be joined by Joe Trippi, senior advisor to the Lincoln Project and longtime political analyst who's joining us now to talk a bit about the Republican National Convention taking place in Milwaukee. Joe Trippi, good morning. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, good to be with you, Pat.
Well, let's jump right into it because there are some questions we've been asking even since long before the convention that I'd love to get your take on, because Donald Trump is who he is. And despite the major media still not seeming to learn that lesson, we're hearing again this week, oh, he's going to be presidential any day now. Oh, this assassination attempt is going to change him and make him kinder and gentler. We know better. Which leads to this question, will the outcome of the convention be that they actually continue to try to put on a more moderate face, or as I've been saying it, are they just going to rip the mask off and say, look, we are who we are and you should come love our brand of extremism?
No, they'll try to appear like they've changed, but it's not going to wash, I don't think. A gentle reminder that the chance of hang Mike Pence were actual calls to hang Mike Pence. I mean, that, and I think the pick of J.D. Vance is going to reveal over time just how extreme and still an insurrectionist party the Trump-led MAGA Republican Party is. So I don't expect this convention to change much. I think this has been essentially a dead heat. It was a dead heat after the debate performance. It's going to be a dead heat. I think the assassination attempt is not going to, first of all, the first two early polls show that that hasn't changed that sort of you know, margin either. And I certainly don't think so far what I've seen in the convention is going to change that. And I do think there's some clear cracks, I think, in the Republican coalition as well that were caused a lot by J.D. Vance's pick. I mean, I think a lot, and the booing of McConnell when he was just announcing that doing the roll call for Kentucky. There's some signs that I still think, even though Nikki Haley showed up because she wants to preserve whatever future she might have in what she thinks may be a return to sanity in the party, I guess, but that's not going to happen either. And I don't think she's going to bridge the gap that's opened over there. I think those Republicans are still gettable by Biden and Democrats and pro-democracy folks as we get closer in November.
I asked at the top of the show, you know, whatever happened to Nikki Haley? Of the many Nikki Haleys, I specifically meant the one who was around from like February until April or so. Nikki Haley is not a sympathetic figure to me, and yet I almost felt a slightest tinge of sadness watching her come out there, knowing what was going on in her head, going, you know, this should have come out completely different, and this is not what this party is. And yet she didn't have, say, the courage of a Liz Cheney or so many others, which leads to the question of whether the Republican Party, as we used to know it, ever does reemerge, or is this more of a Trump MAGA type party for at least the foreseeable future?
Oh no, it's a miscalculation on her part that somehow. Her wing, or whatever you want to call it, her flavor of the old Republican Party could somehow ever come back in power. I mean, J.D. Vance's selection alone shows that where this party is headed, and it is the Donald Trump MAGA, it's Trumpism, and she's got no place there. But I think what you're seeing is what's happened throughout since he came down the escalator. Either you're with him or you're purged, and so you see a lot of people. We've seen it consistently. Who slowly make the move towards Trumpism, towards MAGA, and then become part of it, become enablers of it, and she's now firmly in that camp.
We're talking to Joe Trippi, longtime political strategist who knows a thing or two about economic populism and delivering effective economic messages. And that's what I wanted to ask you about next, because we've talked about J.D. Vance's brand of fake populism, of saying you're standing for the everyday American worker when everything about your record says otherwise. But he has, obviously, from Hillbilly Elegy on down, been able to fool just enough people. So the question I'm sure people ask of you from a strategy standpoint is, how do you counter that? How do you let people know exactly that when J.D. Vance and Donald Trump talk about standing with, you know, the middle class and middle of America, there's nothing in their record that indicates it. But you still have to convey that somehow. What's been your advice?
Well, it looks to me like J.D. Vance was handpicked by the billionaires, Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and a bunch of others who you know, Elon's not out there committing $45 million a month to the Trump camp, Trump super PAC. And boy, it's just sheer coincidence that 2 days later, J.D. Vance, who they were pushing for VP, becomes the nominee. It's clear. It's all about tax cuts for the rich. And by the way, that we'll pay for it with social cuts in Social Security, Medicare, getting rid of regulations. It's exactly the opposite of what J.D. Vance is going to try to sell people. But the record is there, and he's all over the place. I mean, he's only been in the Senate for 2 years. I just think this is a really good pick. For those of us who want to defeat Trumpism in November, There's a lot in this record, a lot, his record, what he said about women, what he, you know, his position on abortion, on IVF, on just about everything when it comes to women's reproductive freedom and taking those freedoms away. He is going, I think, in places like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, in particular, the blue wall states, going to be a huge target and a big help to defeating Trumpism in those three states.
I would imagine that in swing states like Wisconsin and Michigan, Pennsylvania, elsewhere, it would be too simplistic to say that you can only push either an economic message or a message about saving democracy, or a message about social issues such as the Dobbs decision and proposed national abortion bans and things like that. But perhaps I'm wrong. Are there any one of those that you think deserves more emphasis in order to be most effective in a swing state population in the Midwest?
Look, I think all of them. I do think this is going to be a choice election. You have a choice, Wisconsin. You have a choice, America. Do you want national bans on abortion? Or, you know, do you want to reinstate Roe v. Wade? Do you want billionaires getting tax cuts where their plan is to cut? How do they pay for it? By cutting Medicare and Social Security and Head Start programs. Do you want, make the choice on economic terms, on all of it. And I think that is why I still believe with all the hand-wringing in the Democratic Party, that we are going to defeat Trump in November, that Trump's not going to be, regardless of whether it's Joe Biden or the party moves to somewhere else, that's the choice. Do you want democracy, or do you want this, you know, to burn it all down like Trump wants to do? This is the choice you have to face. And yes, you may not be happy with the choice we give you. If people aren't happy with that, but you pick, because that's how it's going to go down. And we have to continue to make that case. And we have to continue to say that he's a threat to democracy, because he is, and not back away from it. Oh, because that's somehow inviting violence or something.
This is Joe Trippi, senior advisor to the Lincoln Project. We're going to continue this conversation on the other side of this break. This is Up North News Radio, live from Lake Wissota on the Civic Media Radio Network. In music history, it was on this day in 1975 that Bob Marley and the Wailers played a historic concert at London's Lyceum Theatre, featuring the version of No Woman, No Cry that became a classic. You can catch the rest of our daily history lesson every morning at 6:50, Monday through Friday. Before we continue on with our conversation with Joe Trippi from the Lincoln Project, a reminder that you can sign up for our daily newsletter over at upnorthnewswi.com. Click newsletter in the top banner. Today's edition includes a mention of National Hot Dog Day, which you can't have without referencing back to our feature story on the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile that still travels through Wisconsin. We talk about, in light of the MLB draft, about some of the big draft picks from the Milwaukee Brewers who never actually played for the Brewers at the major league level. They went on to other teams through trades and acquisitions. And we've got a link to a recent Climate Check segment we had here on the radio program about Project 2025 and exactly what it is and its impact on the climate and other areas. We're talking in our next half hour to author Jennifer Berkshire, who wrote The War on Education. That's part of our homeroom segment coming up. But let's continue our conversation now with Joe Trippi, longtime political strategist, senior advisor to the Lincoln Project. And let's pick up right there on Project 2025. Because, Joe, again, the audacity, the no longer needing to hide behind coded language, they just put it right out there. 900 pages saying, we dare you to read it. And plenty of people saying, oh, there's so much there. It couldn't possibly all come to fruition. But, Joe, there's enough there, and there's enough material for you folks at the Lincoln Project and others to work with. And you certainly have been working at it to get the word out to the public. What all is in today's MAGA Manifesto.
Look, that thing's amazing. And what's clear about it, it's so devastatingly bad that we know for a fact that they, and Rick Wilson talks about this a lot at the Lincoln Project. We know for a fact that they pulled that the stuff in there, and even it was so deadly to Trump and Trumpism in terms of like what they said the quiet part out loud, that that's what caused them to have Trump go out and say, I don't know anything about Project 2025. It's all from everything in there about women's reproductive rights to what they want to do on immigration across the board. It is 80% of Americans, when you test any of this stuff, say no way in hell. Which, by the way, I think that fact, the more people Google Project 2025, read the thing yourself. Don't take my word for it or anybody's word for it, or it's particularly not their word for it. Just read it. And you will be with the 80% that say no way. The other thing that happened, I think, was with when the Supreme Court granted the president, you know, pretty much, total immunity or near it. When they made that ruling, one of the things that spiked, and no one's paying attention to it because of everything else that's happened, is that now 53% of Americans and 53% of independents say respond to this question: Donald Trump is a grave threat to democracy and must not return to the Oval Office. 53% of Americans say yes to that. They agree with that statement. So you put that statement, the immunity that the court's given him, and Project 2025 and J.D. Vance riding shotgun with him, and you have the exact way that the American people get to that 53 number against him, at least, I think. And that's why I think that, yeah, is there problems? Do people have concerns about Joe Biden, whether it's economic, age, whatever? I mean, I understand that. But that's why, yes, he can win. The same is true if the party decides, or Joe Biden decides, to pass the torch. This is a choice election. You can be with the 53% who believe Donald Trump's a grave threat, who look at Project 2025, which is 80% against it when they hear the details. Those are devastating numbers. And J.D. Vance locks that in for him. It wasn't something to move away from it. So, Pat, I really do believe that you're hitting on some of the real points that need to be made as we move forward into November 2024.
And so when people say, well, how can Donald Trump win after hearing all that, you simply look back at 2016, and not just people who voted, but how many people stayed home for various reasons, and how do you motivate them not to get despondent and throw up their hands and just stay home this time around? And I look at this list of former and living Republican office holders, presidential and vice presidential nominees, who will not speak at the convention this year: Paul Ryan, Mike Pence, Dan Quayle, George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Sarah Palin, Mitt Romney. And I ask you this, Joe Trippi. So many of them have just decided to go to ground and accept that this is what their old party is. Is that where it's going to stay? Or might we expect, we always talk about the October surprise, in presidential elections. Might we expect, if not necessarily people on this list, but a few more name brand Republicans saying, guys, you know what? We can't do this. We can't let this happen to our country. Or is that too much to hope for?
Well, let's hope for it, but it may be too much to hope for. There hasn't been a whole lot of courage at all. And again, part of it is you're perched forever. You're perched for life in a party that you believed in for your whole life. And so I do think that there will be. I just think as this crystallizes to be the choice that I think the Biden people wanted to make it, start making that choice clear in the debate, which went horribly wrong and was probably a bad strategic decision in any case, whether the president performed or not, to debate a liar. But the point is, I think that contrast past their Republican convention, because I think they're going to make that contrast even more clear through pick, doing things like picking J.D. Vance, et cetera, that as that crystallizes, I do think you'll see more voices across from independents, Democrats, and Republicans saying, no, this is about democracy. It's about your personal freedom. It's about, do you want NATO to exist or not? Do you want Putin to invade Ukraine and take it all or not? Do you want democracy or this or dictator wannabe? Do you want women's reproductive freedom be decided by the woman and her and medical professionals, or do you want government in there and government deciding that you can't do IVF, that you can't do the contraception is going to be banned, which is all part of Project 2025, by the way. One of the things when you ask about motivation, that thing, 900 pages, has something that should freak out anybody. In other words, you can go to the people of color with this is what he wants to do. You can go to women. This is what he wants to do. You can go to the business community, small business community, and this is what he wants to do. And I think, and anybody who's thinking about sitting on the couch knowing this is what's going to happen to me, you know, is going to get off the couch.
And it's a message that will continue coming from Joe Trippi and the folks at the Lincoln Project. Joe, this was a real thrill. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Have a great day.
Anytime, all right, Matt.
Back with our homeroom segment next. You're up north. Just a reminder, on this third day of the Republican National Convention, that special coverage across the Civic Media Radio Network continues at 7 o'clock this evening with News Director Terry Bell. And, of course, Todd Alba has his 12 to 2 show afternoons live from the convention site, and he will be joining us here in about 15 minutes. But first, we have this week's homeroom segment where we talk about the value of and the threats to public education. And, boy, we've got... We brought out the big guns today. We've got Heather Dubois-Born on from the Wisconsin Public Education Network and the author of The War on Education, Jennifer Berkshire. Heather, Jennifer, nice to have you both here.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, you bet. So, Jennifer, apparently you and Heather go way back, and you said you've got some Wisconsin connections to education as well.
That's correct. I've got a train going by and I'm just going to close my window.
Oh, that's okay.
So, yes, my, my family actually comes from Ashland, way back. And that's one of the places where Heather and I got to go and visit all the way on the shores of the lake. And what was amazing about traveling through Wisconsin was that it really didn't matter who we talked to. People's concerns about the state of their schools and what they would like their schools to look like and do for their kids was remarkably similar. And so I came away from that trip feeling really inspired.
The book is called The Education Wars. I misspoke earlier. The Education Wars, A Citizen's Guide and Defense Manual, which Heather is holding up now for folks watching on social media. I was going to say Jennifer described the book, but Heather, as our like biggest advocate for public education here in the state, and since you know Jennifer, how about you describe what Jennifer does and what her writings are about, and then we'll let Jennifer rebut.
Or bask in the praise.
That would work too, sure.
This is a fantastic manual for people who are wondering what are some of the threats that people are facing to their public schools around the country, and more importantly, what are people doing about it to fight back and what's working. And so I have just delighted in Jennifer's dogged pursuit of this information. For those of you who don't already follow her podcast, Have You Heard? She frequently discusses these topics in great detail and length and gives us an insight into, you know, what people are doing around the country to fight back. And this book really digs deep into what's working there. And it covers Wisconsin, too. So I highly recommend that you pick one up. And if you don't already have a copy, you can grab one at our Summer Summit, where she's going to be talking about this book and lots of other things.
And that's really what prompted this is, Jennifer, you're coming to the Public Education Network Summer Summit later this month. And so when Heather talks about how dogged you have to be, I mean, we've built this whole weekly segment around it, because if you're not dogged about defending public education, I mean, you seem to know more than anybody, you know, you're losing.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that that's really a key observation, is that it's, you know, we take it for granted, right? That like that our public schools will always be there. And what people in a number of states are starting to realize is that the institution is actually way more vulnerable than we thought, and that defending it requires, you know, it can't just fall on teachers or even just the parents of kids who attend the local public school, that we need to be much better about putting together a coalition of people who understand why public schools are important, at both as far as the future of kids, but also for our democracy.
Well, it comes back to that whole notion of the public good and how so much of anything that's prefaced by public has been under attack. Public schools, public transportation, public parks, public health, you name it. And so the point that I think you're making so well here is, even if you sense there's a threat to public education, you can't just leave it to the public educators to do the work. We need everybody in the public to understand it's good. But I suppose, Jennifer, at times you feel like you still have to start at square one and explain why a public education is a public good.
That's right, because we really, you know, all that language about individual choice and markets, you know, that's the air that we breathe. And think about the way that we conceive of higher education. For anyone listening who's, you know, got kids in college or is still paying off having sent kids to college, we think of that as basically an individual good. You put into it, you know, what you want to, you shoulder that debt as your individual responsibility. And I don't think anybody would look at higher ed and think, oh, what a great model. Let's treat K-12 the same way. But that's precisely the direction that we're moving in.
Heather, you wanted to make a point or two about Jennifer, did I? Oh, yeah, there you are. Okay. I wanted to make sure if you had any questions for Jennifer that you wanted to ask as well, that you could.
Well, I guess I'm curious as to how you seem to stay so positive in the face of the enormity of these challenges, and what is really giving you hope as you learn about all of the ways that people are fighting back, because not all of them seem to be entirely successful from where we're sitting, and we certainly feel like we're up against a pretty big mountain here.
That's so true. I was just talking about that yesterday with my husband, who really delights in hearing me talk nonstop about public education all the time. So, you know, I was saying that, you know, on the one hand, like when you think about how tense and frankly demoralizing things are at a national level right now, and you guys know it better than anybody because you've got this crazy convention playing out right in your backyard. But then, you know, like I'll spend my days talking to folks who are organizing on the ground. For example, today is the deadline for folks in Nebraska who are gathering signatures to put a voucher initiative on the ballot there. And there has been an unbelievable amount of pressure from policy elites and big money donors not to let Nebraskans vote on this question. And so as a result, you see all kinds of people who probably don't have strong opinions about school vouchers or whether taxpayers should fund religious education, but they really don't like the idea that somebody's trying to keep them from having a voice. And so I look at something like that and I'm like, wow, there's something interesting happening there. And that's, you know, not just related to the future of schools, but also to, you know, like, how do we get the country back on track? How do we move in a less extreme direction?
Jennifer Berkshire is our guest on our homeroom segment this week, author of The Education Wars, something that she co-authored along with education scholar Jack Schneider. Now, we can talk, Jennifer, about policy all day long and the complexities of getting a referendum passed or legislation passed, but you know as well as any of us that a big part of the key to success from the political right has been in branding, in very simple branding. So I'm just going to throw two of them at you, well, maybe three of them. And you just talk about how those are essentially empty slogans that cover up so much more. There's parents' rights, there's school choice, and there's religious freedom. Now, in just those six words, conservatives have been able to gain so much ground that undermines a public education. Talk about the challenge of taking on any one, two, or three of those basic marketing titles.
The conservative bumper sticker. I thought for sure you were going to say something about funding students, not systems.
No, that too.
Which, you know, I always joke is the equivalent of saying, you know, fund commuters, not roads. So, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot because I really think that a big part of our challenge as believers in public education is that we're stuck defending something that is now very complex. You know, think about how much time we've spent just trying to unpack the various acronyms that are at the heart of so much of what schools do right now, something like social and emotional learning. And, you know, Heather is great about this because I think she understands that often the parent who is really angry and in your face is mad because they feel like there's something they don't understand. And so as a result, the more complex our world gets and the harder it is for us to explain it, when we open ourselves up to these sort of easy bumper stickers, religious freedom, right? The there's no downside to that. Or parents' rights, but it's also, you know, we're alienating a large part of the public who feels like they don't understand what schools do anymore.
Heather, I'm sure you feel the same way about the chore of taking on bumper sticker slogans because there's so much more to it.
Yes, and it is important to understand the motivation and the meaning behind some of this messaging. But the more important thing, to Jennifer's point, is to get to the heart of why people are showing up in the first place and connect with each other in ways that really center what kids need and the reasons that our public schools bring us together in the first place, because we want to live in thriving communities. We want our kids to be able to have a joyful, happy education in our public schools. And we want to be part of eliminating any barriers to that. And so that's why I'm super excited to jump into all of these questions deeper at our annual summer summit, which, as you know, Pat, is going to be July 30 to 31st in Madison. The first day, we're going to have an organizing workshop, and we're going to talk about all of the ways that we can come together through the fall election to really center public education advocacy in a nonpartisan way and make sure that we know where all of the candidates stand on these issues. And then after the election, we are going to hold whomever gets elected accountable for delivering a better budget next year so that we can start to make a difference for kids and close some of the gaps that we're seeing and fight back against, you know, rhetoric that's getting in the way of doing what's right for kids. And we're excited to do all of this and really grateful that Jennifer's bringing her own self to the conversation so that we can learn from things people are doing in other states, too.
To learn more about the Summer Summit, as I say often, it would be a very long website to say Wisconsin Public Education Network. And so they were smart enough to shorten it to Wisconsin Network. So go to wisconsinnetwork.org. Or go to wisconsinnetwork.org/summit to learn more about the summer summit. Jennifer, I'd like your impression on, and you don't have to say this just to be nice to Heather, but do you see an increase in more forceful advocacy for public education, or is Wisconsin an outlier and there are still too many other states where there aren't nearly the public education advocates that there should be?
Wisconsin is definitely leading the way, but in many ways, that's just a reflection of the fact that your public schools have been under attack for so long. I've learned so much from Heather, and I would say that one of the things that I find really inspiring about what's happening is in Wisconsin is that you're starting to see rural communities join forces with suburban and urban counterparts as they start to feel the effects of school privatization. And think about how significant the rural-urban divide has been in Wisconsin. You all, like, you introduced that to many of us in the wake of the 2016 election. Like, you know, we all ran out and got copies of Kramer's book about rural resentment. Well, you know, what if it turns out that we're able to help repair some of that rift through public education advocacy? So I look at something like the work that Heather is doing as a real inspiration, and I talk about it every chance I get.
Heather, I'm sure we'll now give a version of right back at you, Heather.
Yeah, we are seeing people come together across rural, urban, and suburban communities all over the country, because what impacts our school systems in one community impacts everybody. And I think people who really understand what equity looks like when every single kid in every single public school has the resources they need to succeed and thrive, we can start to unravel all of the ways that our own system isn't equitably meeting the needs of all learners, and we can fight back against that. And so it took a while in Wisconsin for some rural communities to see, for example, the impacts of school privatization and the ways that that tightens the belt even harder on districts that are already kind of, you know, doubly damaged by a school finance system that doesn't put kids' needs first, but rather is focused on property values, you know, which is highly problematic, but then is also siphoning money and resources away from kids who need it most. We got to do something about that. And that's why we come together.
So head to wisconsinnetwork.org to learn more about the Summer Summit, and also look up Jennifer Berkshire's book, The Education Wars. Jennifer, so nice to have you here. Thank you for joining us. Safe trip up to Wisconsin. Have a wonderful time when you're here.
Thanks so much. It was a real pleasure.
All right. Thanks, Heather. We'll talk to you again real soon. And coming up next, we'll talk to Todd Alba of the conveniently named Todd Alba Show next. You're up north. It was on this day in 1968 that the fourth Beatles film, Yellow Submarine, debuted, ending with this song, All Together Now. From Lauren on Facebook, just borrowed a copy of The Education Wars from the library this week. Looking forward to reading it. And Chris Hambuck-Boyle, of course, thanks Jennifer and Heather for being part of the show. And again, notes that you can learn more at wisconsinnetwork.org/summit. And one of the big boosters of the Wisconsin Public Education Network is one Todd Alba, who joins us in the midst of a week of covering the Republican National Convention from the convention. Mr. Alba, how's it going so far?
Mr. Kreitler, Mr. Bach, you know, I'm surviving.
Wait a minute, we got survival. Right. We got survival music.
You are, and we all are having a better week than the unfortunate case of the woman who was singing the national anthem at the Home Run Derby night before last. Greg, I didn't put her statement in front of me, but essentially she said, I'm not going to kid you. I was drunk and I'm heading to rehab.
Yep.
So as much as we all, there's so many bad renditions of the national anthem. We just lumped her into it and only come to realize that now she's realizing she may have a problem, and hope she gets the help that she needs.
Yeah, I saw.
I certainly hope she does as well.
I saw somebody make a comment that he said is a country star, and he said, I've turned down every offer to sing the national anthem because it's high risk, no reward. If you do well, it's fine, whatever. If you do poorly, you are the butt of the joke. I'm like, I understand that too. Like, I would never do that.
You know, and I've heard a couple of renditions, a couple of good ones, but I don't remember them. So, yeah, I wouldn't say it was a big reward. Unless your name is Marvin Gaye, there's really, I mean, you or Whitney Houston.
Whitney Houston,
two people who completely reimagined the national anthem. But to do it as is can be somewhat painful, but I'm sure Todd has heard that at the convention. You've heard God Bless the USA. as Donald Trump came out on stage with what appeared to be a hotel pillow attached to the side of his head, a bandage which, by the way, wasn't there the day after the shooting, but magically showed up when he was at the convention site. Are other people wearing ear pillows in sympathy to the former president out there?
I think I saw one.
Okay.
And there was a great meme of a guy that just had like a sanitary napkin attached to his ear, which was fantastic. I really enjoyed that. I just figured
for all the people that showed up when Trump was in court, they showed up in New York, all in these same suits, the blue suit with the long red tie.
Yeah.
And I fully expect the ear bandage is going to become a similar symbol before this campaign is all said and done.
Yeah, they interviewed one sitting Republican congressman. The name escapes me, but he had that an ear bandage on his ear in homage and unity with Trump.
So
it's been that kind of convention.
Yeah. What's your impression so far? I mean, look, you're filled with a whole lot of Trump supporters, and they're all very upbeat given the way the campaign cycle has gone at this point when there's still so much time left. But, you know, nary a bad thing to say about what's happening inside the convention so far.
I would say a couple of things. A, I think you nailed it, Pat, that Republicans here at the convention are absolutely lockstep unified. I mean, you had the parade of, you know, oh, I guess I was wrong candidates, Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis and Ted Cruz and all the rest. You know, on our show, we like to play the thing from Hamilton, you know, you'll be back, wait and see. And you know, and they just keep coming back. They just keep coming back to Trump. And so you have that. But here's the thing. They are absolutely unified. Again, you've completely condemned violence in politics. That's a given. But the incident over the weekend has done nothing but absolutely fire these delegates up. And I think the real question, or one of the real questions going into November is, and certainly next month in Chicago, are Democrats going to be able to match that energy, that unity, get behind Joe Biden and say we're going to let differences within our party, within our caucuses go aside and really get behind Joe Biden because the stakes are so high?
I'd like to answer that question. No. No, because that's not what Democratic conventions are usually about. It's somebody or a group.
If that's the case, the Democrats are in real trouble. The nation's in real trouble.
That's the bottom line. I got a point on that. I'm going to say again, no, because this convention is a blip in the process. The Democratic convention is a blip in the process. The debate was a blip in the process. And in an election that is still 50-50, or what the latest poll was like 46-46, whatever it is, I mean, this is... What do I always liken it to? The Olympic sport of speed skating. The long ones were like for the first seven laps around the oval, they're going super slow. And then that last lap, they are skating like you know, a tiger is chasing them. And that's kind of what this campaign is. And I'm not discounting all of these things that happen. But there's so many people ready to jump on, you know, board right now and say, this thing is over, when every poll indicates, folks, you better pay attention every day between now and then, because you just never know what's going to happen next.
Not say it's over. I agree with you, Pat. There's a long time, but I do think that, I mean, these people, as you well know, in the Democratic Party, I've seen the Republican Party, the delegates, the people that go, they're the people that lead the charge to register people, to get out the vote, all those kinds of things. And at least on the Republican side, from what I'm seeing, they're ready to go. Tony Zimmerman on Facebook asks, do you agree with Rick Wilson that Ron Johnson is the cheese curd Ted Cruz? Ron Johnson is just a goof. I mean, he gave a very divisive, hateful speech, transphobic speech on the floor here, and then threw his staff under the bus and said, well, my staff loaded the wrong speech on the teleprompter. Give me a break.
But now, at first, I doubted that there was even a kinder, gentler speech version out there, but then they posted a picture of it to Twitter. It had all the transphobic stuff still in it. So, no, it wasn't a kinder, gentler speech. That's not how Ron Johnson works. And then went on, we played the soundbite earlier of Ron Johnson giving an interview where he said, you know, the Secret Service failed because of a DEI hire at the top. So Ron Johnson can't can't speak without some thinly veiled misogyny or racism coming out, rumor mongering. These are the things he does. So everything's been on brand so far.
I would also say, I haven't had a chance to watch a lot of the network coverage. We've been really busy at Panther Arena next to Fiserv. A lot of great press people here, by the way, getting enjoying talking about some of my colleagues. But this all seems very quote-unquote normal. And I haven't seen a lot of press talking about this is a unique, unprecedented convention because we've never had in American history, modern American history, a 34-time convicted felon. Last night was supposed to be about keeping America safe again, and they started off endorsing a felon, a criminal. I mean, why we're not talking about that more, I don't know.
I like how Todd just slips in. You know, I was talking to my colleagues, you know, Lester Holt and David Muir and Norah O'Donnell and, you know, Todd Alba. No, all right, no. There. His colleagues.
Oh, if only.
More from him coming up.